All right, so welcome back to Church and State again. This is Magnificat Radio. My name is Stephen Cox, your host, and I want to welcome back to the show Gabriel Sanchez, a blogger who's been on the show before, talked about economics, just wages, who writes for Opus Publicum. Gabriel's a lawyer. Gabriel, are you there?
I am here. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Good to hear you again on the show. Well, we're glad you're back, and I wanted to talk to you about a topic you've been writing about recently on your blog, and that is basically the intersection of Pope Leo, economic liberalism, and the Acton Institute. We talked about Acton before. It's a think tank based out of Grand Rapids, Michigan. One of its researchers, Samuel Gregg, I think he's the director of research over there, is hosting in Rome, I think in the next coming days, a symposium on the economic thought of Pope Leo XIII. And I think Gregg's position is essentially that Pope Leo would be a sort of free market guy who would likely subscribe to the Acton Institute's way of thinking about free markets, government regulation. Speak to us about the plausibility of that theory. Is Pope Leo a sort of free market pope? What was his economic views?
Well, obviously, the symposium is being held in honor of the, I believe it's the 125th anniversary of Rerum Novarum, which is his great social encyclical, which sort of launched sort of the modern era of Catholic social teaching.
Right.
And what Gregg and the Acton Institute, and they're not alone in this, there are certainly other economic liberals in the Catholic world who push this idea. What they like to do is they like to look at Rerum Novarum, and they like to look at the passages in that encyclical which talk about the right to property being a natural right, which is fine. That's part of Catholic teaching. People have a right to their property, and the government shouldn't just expropriate it willy-nilly. And certainly one of the big concerns at that point in time in the 19th century was the rise of socialism, and there's a real strong concern with that. So while they get it right that Leo, of course, affirms the right to property, they ignore large other swaths of that encyclical. Probably the most important thing they ignore, I think, in that encyclical is when Leo speaks about just wages. And he speaks about that as being a principle of natural justice. In other words, that's not just simply a principle that sort of emerges from revelation, but that's a principle that's available, that can be known, in theory at least, by all people everywhere at all times. And that's something that the Acton Institute and Gregg like to ignore. But I think what's more important, well, equally important to keep in mind is that Rerum Novarum launched sort of the modern social magisterium. It's not the conclusion of it. It's not the apex. And within decades after Leo wrote, you had St. Pius X, and you also had Pius XI after him, speaking on social and economic issues. And they reaffirmed the need for just wages. Also in Rerum Novarum, Leo affirms that there is a need for the government to step into the marketplace sometimes, especially when people are being defrauded of their wages, or when you have particular classes, not just economic classes, but certain sort of classes of human beings who are not being given the right and the ability to develop a living for themselves and to support their families and to create savings. And this is something that Gregg and the Acton Institute kind of kick to the side, and I think that's extremely problematic.
Yeah, I think one thing they do also is to view all sort of regulation as sort of this burdensome, a sort of soft socialism, and it's this way of viewing economics that is, it's through an economic liberal lens. I mean, it's not a authentically Catholic one. It's a modern free market based hermeneutic that is, you know, perhaps even indifferent. I mean, I was reading Gregg's essay, and it's over at Crisis, I think, online, on like Crisis Magazine online. And he basically was saying that natural inequalities exist. And of course, that's true. But the way in which he was contextualizing that was that, well, the inequalities in the free market is basically God's will, that some people should be rich, others should be poor. I mean, this is an extreme version of economic liberalism that tends to be coming out of the Acton Institute.
Right, absolutely. I mean, the problem with Acton, at least in my opinion, this is the problem with Gregg's thought, is that they take the market as kind of being this neutral, overarching force within society, that any sort of intervention in the market from government and so forth is going to be per se illegitimate. It's going to cause more problems than it corrects. And that if we just simply let the market run on its own, everybody will be better off. The problem with this view is that, again, not that property is a bad thing, not that business is a bad thing, not that people shouldn't be able to go out and make money and be entrepreneurs. The problem is that, of course, you have situations where people are not able to sustain themselves, not without government transfer payments, not without some sort of public support, not without going into horrible amounts of debt from credit cards and usurious loans and other problems. And Acton and Greg kick all that stuff to the side, and they don't really take that stuff seriously. And that's why I think it's really important when you talk about the social magisterium, when you talk about Leo XIII's thought, you have to put it in the context of everything, not just what Leo was writing, but also look at what the other popes subsequent to him also developed along those lines. And that's something that, like I said, Greg and the Acton Institute simply refuse to do. They just kick all that stuff to the side.
Right. I think it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned selectivity there. I mean, they'll quote Rerum Novarum all day long till they're blue in the face, but they'll never quote Immortale Dei or Libertas or all these other great encyclicals by Pope Leo that talk about the need for the church and the state to have a relationship, the idea that, you know, there is the social kingship of Christ. I mean, Greg never speaks about that.
No, he doesn't. And I think he doesn't do it because if you look at what Acton's mission has been, it has been to, at least this is my view of it after having studied a lot of the writings, is that they're really trying to support liberalism first, and where they can pull bits and pieces from the Catholic magisterium to sort of fit in and support their liberal orientation, they'll do so. And I think for them, to speak of the social kingship of Christ, to speak of the true religion being the Catholic faith, to them that would be an embarrassment. It'd be an embarrassment because it would undercut their, I don't want to call it an ecumenical mission, but certainly they try to appeal to Protestants, even non-Christians for that matter, their viewpoint.
And it is interesting, this is a bit off topic, but you know, Notre Dame is awarding Joe Biden and John Boehner the Laetare Medal. It's the school's highest award, and rightfully so, folks are criticizing John Boehner for getting the award, or Joe Biden, excuse me, from getting the award because, you know, he's been in office for a lifetime, and for the past 50 years, he supported, you know, pro-choice, and just up until recently, you know, so-called gay marriage positions. But John Boehner, I mean, this free market guy, global capitalism, he supported NATO in the 1990s. Should Catholic schools be recognizing those economic liberals, I think like John Boehner, with these sorts of awards?
No, I don't think so. And I think beyond that, I think one of the problems here is that the Catholic Church has lost so much footing, and all Christians, really, conservative Christians have in the United States, we've lost so much footing in the public sphere that now any politician in the mainstream, whether Democrat or Republican, who seems to reflect on some level our core beliefs, or at least seems to have some sort of plausible connection to issues that concern us, abortion, of course, being probably the primary one, you know, we flock to them and say, oh, look, you know, this is someone who's worthy of respect, worthy of reward. And I don't want to say I don't want to disrespect John Boehner.
No, right.
But whether or not a Catholic institution, you know, probably the most high profile, prestigious Catholic institution in the United States, should be awarding this man who clearly has taken political positions over the course of his career, which are contrary to the Catholic teaching. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's very troublesome. And that's really something that I would wish Notre Dame and every Catholic school would just get out of that business altogether.
I think one of the big problems is too, and you know, we're speaking about Notre Dame. I was listening to a lecture recently by Vincent Philip Munoz, who's a professor there. And he was speaking at the Thomistic Institute in New York. And Munoz is one of these neoconservatives, very much of the position that the American founding, the principles at that time, are not really to blame for our current issues in regards to religious liberty, freedom of conscience that we're experiencing in the United States. Basically, his argument is that folks like Patrick Deneen, who are skeptical of liberalism, and I think he would even characterize you, Gabriel, because you've written about this, who say liberalism is not going to save us. Munoz is arguing in his speech that basically we need to return to the founders. You've written about this. You've written about integralism. Where is that position incorrect? And what is in your view, the way forward for Catholics in the United States?
Well, I think the main flaw of this is that liberalism begins with this I'll put it this way. I think liberalism's anthropology is flawed. It begins with human beings, comes up with this idea, this package of rights that they claim by nature, whether or not that's provable or not is of course debatable. But what, you know, they begin with human beings and where we're at and our rights to freedom,
right.
Sort of this unlimited freedom. That we have, so long as we're not harming other persons.
Right.
You know, there's the old saying where, you know, the right to swing my fist ends at the next person's nose.
Sure.
And that seems to be it for them. After that, everyone's free to sort of develop their way of life, develop how they think the world ought to be, develop how, you know, their own sort of independent way of being.
But of course, Munoz would say that's a sort of liberalism that the founders never truly espoused, right?
Which I find difficult to swallow, because if you go back to the earliest writing, Declaration of Independence, and even the sort of original iteration of the Constitution, 1787, it's all based around, and of course with the Bill of Rights attached to that as well, it's all based around the rights of individual human beings. There's no discussion whatsoever of the rights of God. There's no discussion of the need for a just society to recognize.
Would you agree that the founders speak of natural law, natural rights? They speak of an existence in God. I mean, they're largely deists. Right. They never put a real check on that in government to secure all of that to continue, right?
Right, and I think somebody like those apologists, whether Catholic or not, for the American project, for the advent of the United States in the 18th century, would argue that sort of the lip service that's given to natural law and natural rights in the Declaration and other early writings of the founders, they would say, well, look, you know, that points towards, for example, what Catholics think of when we speak about natural law. And they would argue that, look, you know, there's a moral underpinning to America that simply has been lost or misunderstood.
Yep.
The problem with that argument, of course, is that there really isn't a whole lot of evidence from the beginning of the American founding up to present time that any of that rhetoric was ever taken all that seriously. Certainly in the late 19th century, early 20th century, we start hearing discussions of natural rights and natural law. A lot of it's put in economic terms, you know, the natural right to, you know, develop my own, you know, not just develop my own business, but to have no intervention from the government.
Which is what Greg does, essentially.
Right, right. And that type of thing is illicit. But they never sort of speak in sort of stronger moral terms about what that means for the shape of society.
Mm-hmm. There's been an emerging school of thought of which I think you identify with, again, as the sort of integralist or maybe illiberal Catholicism in the United States. And let me read a quote here. I was reading a piece on First Things, which, interestingly enough, I think you maybe agree with this, is that they're recognizing the flaws in the American project, and they're saying, look, liberalism is not going to save us. And they brought some writers on there recently, one being Elliot Milko, and he wrote an essay on this, and he says, he lays out what we're talking about, you know, the problems with the United States, where it's come from. But he says this in his article, which I thought was the key point, quote, when one recognizes that man is a political animal, it is impossible to avoid the conclusion the Catholic Church must, by virtue of its mission, seek to convert the public square and the powers which govern it to Christ. And yet, for decades, the church hierarchy in the United States has maintained a cautious, hands-off approach to engagement in politics. And he goes on to argue, basically, when the bishops speak, they speak as benevolent humanitarians, and they don't proclaim the kingship of Christ. Is that at the heart of the integralist position?
Well, it's certainly at the heart of the integralist critique of liberalism, certainly. And I think at the heart of the integralist position would be that Christ's social kingship needs to be taken seriously. And this is something that really it's strange to even give it a specific term, calling it integralist, where, you know, 70, 80 years ago, you would have just thought of this as Catholic.
Right.
This would have been common sense and affirmed not just in papal teachings, but certainly Catholic theologians and writers. I mean, this was taken as normative.
Yep.
Now we're so far away from it that when you start speaking of integralism and you start taking the kind of positions that Milko does or myself or somebody like Father Edmund Waldstein, you know, now it's looked at as sort of this strange novelty. Mm-hmm. But really what we're doing, I mean, when we make these types of arguments, we make these types of claims, we're simply trying to reattach the kind of arguments that we're making today with the Catholic tradition itself. And there's been, you know, however you want to measure it, probably a 70, 80 year breach between the last time you really saw Pope speaking forcefully on this and where we are today.
Right. Well, Gabriel, that's, I think, all the time we unfortunately have for today. What have you been up to lately? And again, where can we find your writing and on social media? Where are you at?
Sure. So my blog is Opus Publicum, spelled OPUSPUBLICUM.com. On there, you will see not just my blogging efforts, but there's a little tab called Writings. You can find things I wrote for The Angelus, The Remnant, Ethica Politica. I also used to write about aviation law, if anyone's interested in that.
Right, right.
You can find those kind of writings on there as well. Also, Opus Publicum is my Twitter handle. Feel free to message me, follow me, whatever you know, criticism. I certainly invite people who don't necessarily agree with everything I say to have thoughtful criticisms. It certainly helps me out. Also, I think I mentioned before, I don't know if I mentioned this on the last show, but working on a book on integralism. I'm telling myself October is when it has to be done. We'll see how that works out. But it's my second book I've written, and I know from the first experience, timetables can be very difficult to handle.
Right. Well, keep up the great work. We really enjoy your writing and listening to you, and thanks for being on Church and State Amendment Radio.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, Gabriel. We appreciate you being on. And, folks, that is all for today's episode of Church and State. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter at Stephen Cox. And be sure to visit the MagnificatMedia.com website where you can find all of our previous shows. Again, God bless and take care.
Serving the faithful of the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. This is Magnificat Radio and MagnificatMedia.com.